This is Central Time. Now, recent changes to the multi-state Great Lakes Compact could impact how municipalities outside of the immediate watershed are granted access to the lakes for water. While the rule changes were welcomed by some, other leaders argue that the new guidelines don't go far enough and don't fully include all groups with a stake in the issue, and that includes tribal organizations. Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. How you doing?
Good. Well, the Great Lakes Compact is this big, kind of complicated deal. What are some of the changes here that the member states are approving?
So it's pretty technical and procedural. They're changing the rules and procedures for how these withdrawals are reviewed and how council decisions would be appealed. And I guess pretty much it seems like most of the angst with the decision by the council is what wasn't included in these changes. John Dickert, who is the former mayor of Racine, he is now the president of the Great Lakes Mayors and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, and they take issue with the changes because they feel like they don't allow enough public input on water diversion proposals.
Well, let's look at the compact a little bit big picture. The simple part of the rules is if you're completely outside the watershed, if you're a state away or even a few counties away, you can't touch the water. A lot of the gray area is people who are in straddling communities, right? Cities that are partly in the watershed or partly not, or in straddling counties. Those are the communities where there's a decision to make, right, about whether or not they can withdraw water.
Right, yeah. The whole intent of the compact was to make it, or at least that the mayors would argue, is to make it more difficult to divert water from the Great Lakes Basin. And so, as you said, the only communities that can do that are the ones that are straddling that basin line or are located in a county that straddles the basin. So, yeah, you're right. It's intended so that only there would only be a few exceptions to this rule, and that's where the Compact Council comes in and makes these decisions on proposals that come forward, like the city of Waukesha or Mount Pleasant.
Oh, the Foxconn industrial development.
Right, yeah. Earlier this year, Wisconsin approved up to 7 million gallons per day to be diverted from the city of Racine to Mount Pleasant to serve that plant. You know, that's been challenged by environmental groups, and that's still ongoing.
And you mentioned mayors and some others worried about the changes that weren't in this new look for the compact. And one of those seems to be about getting public input. What were some of the critics hoping to see when it came to getting the public involved in decisions for communities like, say, Waukesha or Mount Pleasant or community to be named later?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that they really wanted to see with this whole process when things are reviewed is a mandatory public hearing in each state or province. You know, John Dickert, again, the former mayor of Racine, says if you're going to be diverting Great Lakes water, that's something that every state and province should have a voice in, as well as First Nations and tribes. And so they want to have public hearings held everywhere before those decisions are made. And right now, it's kind of where the council will hold a hearing if it's of interest to the state or to the province. It's not required.
And you also reported that you just mentioned First Nations or tribal organizations have concerns about changes that weren't made. What kinds of things are we hearing there?
Yeah, First Nations and tribes have said they want a greater role, a greater voice in the council's consideration of these proposed water diversions. The Anishinaabeg Nation in Canada, which represents around 40 tribes, I believe, there, has said that the council should recognize First Nations and tribes who are not just stakeholders, that they have jurisdiction over the lakes. Then they argued yesterday again when the council was holding its meeting that they never ceded their rights to lake beds and waters under treaties. So they feel that they should have a voice in whether or not these water diversions are approved.
So with these two sets of concerns you raised, tribal concerns and then concerns about public hearings in each state and province involved, is there an idea that, okay, we've made these changes, but we're going to keep looking, the Great Lakes Compact members, we're going to keep looking at the agreement and maybe addressing these issues? Or is it, okay, dust our hands off. We've done what we're going to do, and we're done for a while.
Yeah, no, the Compact Council has argued all along that this is just another step in the process, that there are going to be other tests of the Compact Council, and that with each new experience, they are better prepared to face the concerns or make modifications or adjust things so that they are responsive to some of the fears that people have regarding these proposed diversions. So they've said that, you know, some of the things that they might talk about in the upcoming year would be discussions over monitoring and enforcement of proposed diversions, because right now I don't believe there's anything there that says that these diversions must be monitored, and to enforce that the amount of water that is diverted is in fact what is being withdrawn from the lakes.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Danny, the two big stories in water diversion since the Great Lakes Compact, as we mentioned, Waukesha here in Wisconsin,
right.
Foxconn here in Wisconsin. Are we getting some side eye from the other states? Like, hey, why is Wisconsin putting all these things to the test?
Well, I guess that's just where the controversy is and the proposals are. I mean, as you said, Waukesha was at the center of it, with up to around 8.2 million gallons of water per day being diverted from Lake Michigan, and also Foxconn now. And that one is going to be very interesting, as environmental groups have challenged it, because they're arguing that it doesn't meet the requirements of the compact, because they're withdrawing it for a commercial use rather than a public water supply use. The DNR has said otherwise, that doesn't actually serve the public. So it'll be up to that whole process to decide whether or not it in fact meets the intent of the compact.
Danny, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News based in Superior. She joined us with the latest on changes coming to the Great Lakes Compact that dictates how municipalities can withdraw water from the Great Lakes, where they have to be, and how they do it. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to new U.S. Census data, incomes are rising here in Wisconsin, but a lot of that story depends on which part of the state you live in. The data compares the period from 2013 to 2017 with the previous five-year period, which included the Great Recession. Median household incomes rose about $4,000 inflation-adjusted dollars between those periods, but the percentage of people living in poverty held pretty steady at around 12%. The report also took a look at the rate of uninsured people in the state and for the first time examined internet and technology access in Wisconsin. Abdur Chaudhry is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Marquette University. Abdur, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me again on your program.
Well, the census, it's one way to measure the economy. There's lots of others. There's this huge big data dump yesterday, and I think people are making sense of it. But top of your head, looking at what they're saying, what does this tell us about our economy here in Wisconsin, Abdur?
Overall, I think when you talk about income and poverty, I think this is what we had expected. After the Great Recession of 2008, we did see a drop in income and also an increase in poverty level. We expected that in the last couple of years that would change, and that's what we have seen in this household survey. Overall, income has increased statewide between 2013 and 2017. Compared to the previous 5 years. Overall, poverty has dropped slightly, household poverty, compared to the previous 5 years. So the overall picture looks promising. However, there are certain areas that are of concern.
Yeah, what areas are you watching about and worrying about?
There are a couple of things. One is we do see a north-south divide in the state. If you look at income or poverty, what we do see is that the southern counties in Wisconsin are doing much better compared to the northern rural counties. Also, we have seen some drop in income and also some increase in poverty level in the Milwaukee County, especially the inner city area. They're not doing very well. That's one concern we have. And another thing that we have seen in this census is the lack of high-speed internet access throughout the state. If you take the state overall, we are lagging behind both Minnesota and Illinois, our neighboring states. And then if you look within the state, here also we see a lot of disparity, especially the northern counties. They're lacking behind in internet access. Also, lower income areas in the state, they're also lagging behind. So that's an area of concern for policymakers and also who are looking at the state.
And I've seen people make the case that that's a really important economic development issue. If you want to start a new business, you want to go where you can get access to high-speed internet, probably. If you want to lure contractors or remote workers to your community, you have to have high-speed internet. Is that something that could potentially, that difference in access, leave local communities further behind than they already are?
Yes, and that is really a concern that I have. What is happening now that, you know, you do see technology developing at such a fast rate throughout the country. So counties and areas that are lagging behind that do not have access to high-speed internet, they will fall behind in many different ways. They won't be able to attract businesses, as you said. Schools in those areas will not be able to provide the latest technology to its students. So it will fall behind. It's sort of a vicious cycle that they will be in.
I've seen people more and more lately compare low-income areas in big cities like Milwaukee and low-income rural areas, saying they have a lot more in common than we might think. Lack of jobs, issues with schools and school funding. The list goes on. Economic despair in some ways. Are there common themes? Are there common solutions to what, on the face of it, look like very different kinds of communities?
I agree with you. Although there is some differences in these communities. So, for example, when you compare inner city Milwaukee with any northern county in Wisconsin, there are a lot of differences. But there are some similarities, too, in terms of access to various things that would help to promote these areas. We do see a lack of access, both in the inner city areas as well as in the rural areas. So if we want to have a sort of a sustainable growth statewide, we do need to look into these areas and see how we can provide, for example, broadband internet access to areas that are not getting it right now.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Abdur, we're comparing a time period that was right smack in the middle of the Great Recession and now this period of recovery. Have we recovered as much as we would have expected by now?
In terms of income and poverty, we have not recovered. Wisconsin is not doing as well as a couple of other Midwestern states like Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota. But we have recovered. Our current position is much better than where we were in 2008. But I wish we could have been in a much higher position today.
Abdur, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me again.
Abdur Chaudhry is a professor emeritus of economics at Marquette University. He joined us today to talk about new census data looking at Wisconsin's economy. Are you planning on hosting any dinners this holiday season? Maybe you've got a particular kind of meat or fish or a vegetarian option in mind. Our Food Friday guest today has three words for you: sear, deglaze, and embellish. She came out with a new book that's all about easy-to-make entrees and flavorful, versatile sauces to go with them. Susan Volan is a freelance writer, chef, and cookbook collaborator in Seattle. She's the author of the new book, Searing Inspiration: Fast, Adaptable Entrees and Fresh Pan Sauces. It was selected by NPR as one of its best books of 2018. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, I love the approach you're taking. You know, some cookbooks are like, you know, chemistry textbooks. You got to follow the instructions precisely and get things just right. You're giving us really a method that we can learn and adapt along the way. Talk about the inspiration for doing that.
Well, funny that you say that, because I actually worked on one of those, or several of those really tweaky chemistry-based books. And I think this book is kind of that screeching U-turn from that technique, because I went from measuring hard-to-pronounce ingredients in quarters of a gram into, hey, why not just throw a skillet on the pan and make some good dinner, what sounds good, and maybe using some wine from your glass to start it.
And you've got kind of a three-step process. Actually, basically every recipe in here, you've got prep, sear, and sauce. Those are the three stages. Let's talk about searing a little bit. What do we mean when we're talking about searing our fish, meat, or other protein?
Well, we're talking about a surface technique, something that is going to be browning. It's essentially browning, and that concentrates the flavors and just it's a quick fix, all done in a controlled heat of a skillet. And I think it's really important that people know how to wield a skillet thoughtfully and well, because I think a hot pan can be sort of intimidating for people. It's so simple, and yet sometimes it's so easy to get wrong. So I try to just reassure people that there are a few techniques and a few ways to handle a pan which will forever, forever make you some great dinners.
Yeah, the one of your little tips, and I've heard this elsewhere, and I still can't bring myself to do it. I don't know why. Heat the pan first, get the pan hot, then you add the oil. Why?
Absolutely, always. And you have trouble with that?
I don't know. I want to get the oil out. I feel weird about heating an empty pan. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think part of that is because there have been warnings, especially on pans with coatings on them, that you should never heat them empty. But if you use a pan, like I suggest, that doesn't have any kind of a treatment or coating in it, it's okay to just heat it up on the stove. And the reason I suggest that is because then you get that oil, you get the pan to the right temperature, then you add the oil and it instantly gets to that right temperature too, as opposed to putting oil, cold oil in a pan and essentially cooking it and not really knowing when it's the right temperature. And it also really secures that nonstick properties of a pan that isn't nonstick. It gives you that sort of hydroplaning action that means that you never need to use a nonstick pan for these recipes.
And for the sauce part of the equation here, a little stickiness maybe isn't so terrible?
Oh, it's the best part. Yeah, I've done recipes side by side, actually, very simple recipes side by side in a pan with a nonstick coating and a pan with a regular coating, and gave them blind tasting to people, and they all chose the one prepared in a regular skillet over the one in the nonstick pan, because it's that stickiness, it's that concentrated juices and those brown flavors that work as a base for these pan sauces. We just rehydrate them, we liquefy them, and we turn them into this wonderful sauce to go with whatever you cooked.
Now, before we get into a specific recipe, let's turn to the sauce side of the equation. I get a little intimidated by the concept of, ooh, making a reduction sauce, or, you know, and I've looked at recipes where they're like, I don't know, all day processes, something like that. You make it really simple. Talk about the basics of you've seared the meat or whatever, and now we're turning it into a sauce.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the same techniques are repeated over and over again through the book. It's those fundamentals of a sear, listening to it, getting it nice and brown, then using the most of those little brown sticky bits on the bottom of the pan, which are going to be turned into aromatics. We throw in some garlic and some shallots. We add some flavors into those, and then we do the deglazing techniques, which can be used with any flavorful liquid. I always recommend wine, white wine or red wine, depending on what the main dish is, or some vermouth. But I also use carrot juice sometimes, or I use stock, or I use a little bit of vinegar works really well to make that hydration. And then you cook it down to a couple tablespoons and embellish it with fresh seasonal vegetables or a condiment that you might have. I've recently made shrimp with some orange marmalade, and those are the embellishments. They still can only take 2 or 3 minutes. It doesn't take long. And then you have a sauce, and you have, once you understand those fundamentals, you can mix and match and play around with ingredients you have on hand or come up with anything that sounds good to you that night.
Talking to Susan Voland, author of Searing Inspiration, Fast Adaptable Entrees and Fresh Pan Sauces on this week's edition of Food Friday. Now, Susan, you shared a few recipes with us. We have these online, by the way, WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's check one of them out now. Chicken with buttery fresh tomato and basil sauce. It's still in that that familiar process. Talk through this particular recipe.
Well, chicken is one of those things that a lot of people ask me. I wrote another big book on sauces, and people said, I've got chicken, I need something to serve with, and I'm tired of what I usually do. So chicken is something that everyone often has on hand. So I used a boneless, skinless chicken breast. I sear them till they're nice and brown but not dried out. Take them out of the pan, and then make a quick pan sauce with all these fundamental techniques and ingredients that people often have on hand, which is some garlic, a little pinch of red chilies, And then some diced tomatoes. You can use canned diced tomatoes or a fresh diced tomato, maybe just, you know, a cup, a little bit till it gets saucy, just a little bit. And then some white wine and butter, a touch of butter, and then fresh chopped basil on top. And you spoon that over the chicken, and it's not like a tomato sauce, and it's not like a butter sauce. It's like this beautiful amalgam of both with these fresh flavors of herbs and basil on there.
And what
works with fish. Works beautifully with fish. It works well with tofu if you'd like.
I was just going to say, one of the things I love about the book is you talk through this recipe. It's chicken with this sauce, but you give tips on mixing and matching. Okay, use the same sauce, but do it with fish or tofu or something else.
Yeah. Every recipe in the book says this sauce also goes well with, because the whole point of it isn't necessarily following one particularly locked in recipe, but it's understanding the techniques and then being able to make them work for you. So if you're not a fish eater or you don't like chicken, you can make it with a portobello mushroom cap or a lamb chop.
And another recipe you shared with us, again, we have this up at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is the ancestral recipe, I think, of everything in the book. Here's what it's called. It's been a long damn day, wine from your glass pan sauce. Talk about that one.
That's actually the impetus of the whole book. I did write another book, and that was a recipe at the end, kind of saying, listen, we've talked about sauces, but what you really want at the end of the day sometimes is something easy and made in the same skillet. So it's these fundamentals of searing something. You've had a long day. You just want something to eat. And with these fundamentals, you can use what you have in the fridge, even eggs, and you can use the ingredients you have on hand, and you can usually have a meal done before a pizza would be delivered. I know I can. So it's that kind of sear, add aromatics, deglaze the pan, add something that's handy, maybe a touch of butter, put it on a plate, throw something fresh or crunchy or some kind of garnish on top, and your day suddenly is a little bit easier, and it's a nicer to sit down and have a meal. And it's a better way to, I don't know, celebrate a long damn day.
And this is, I don't know, for me, this is more fun cooking. I'll say this is more up my alley than the precisely follow the exact recipe mode of cooking. Do you have more fun doing it this way? Because you've done a lot of both.
Well, I think it is, the way I cook is very spontaneous and kind of unstructured, but I'm married to somebody who likes really structured recipes. So the recipes have to, I know some people are really comfortable following specific recipes. So I understand the value of that, and I have included that, but I do always urge them to say, hey, if you like more garlic, add more garlic. Or if you taste it and you think it needs a little something, think about what it needs. Maybe put in a squeeze of lemon juice. And yes, it is fun. It is the better you are at these things, and the more you trust yourself, and the more you consciously take, what I like to say too is that if you don't like the taste of it and you try to cook for other people's taste, there's a chance that no one at the table is going to like what's for dinner. But if you cook for your own taste and you make it taste right for you, then at least somebody is going to be happy and enjoying their dinner.
And part of the goal in the book is a learning process, I think. So each time we make something, maybe we look at it and say, oh, what if next time I added blank? Is that part of how we learn to be good cooks along this line?
Oh, I hope so. I think so. Yes. Trying something new. I mean, granted, pickle juice and grapefruit aren't always going to work out for you, but, you know, you'll learn that. You'll learn that with practice, right?
Two great tastes that taste great together. So what do you have a next experiment, a next frontier that you want to try now, Susan?
Right now, I'm really happy with searing and sauces. I'm kind of trying to spread the gospel of sauce everywhere I go and try to take some of the mystery and the formality out of it and remind people that, you know, a piece of fish is great, but a piece of fish with a quick sauce on it is, you know, quite spectacular.
We'll leave it there. Susan, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Voland is a freelance writer, chef, and cookbook collaborator in Seattle. She's the author of the book we've been talking about. It's called Searing Inspiration, Fast, Adaptable Entrees and Fresh Pan Sauces. NPR picked it as one of the best books of 2018. We've got three, actually, of her recipes posted online. Two that we talked about, the wine from your glass pan sauce, the chicken with buttery fresh tomato and basil sauce. This one looks good, too. Pan-toasted rustic bread with Swiss cheese and wine sauce. Find those at WPR.org/Food Friday or on the Ideas Network Facebook page.